Right.
Down here in Hermosa Beach. Now, she has been the hub, pretty much, of the old China hands, you know, the Laotian, at least. And she was in Vietnam, too. So, she, Don Luce has been here many times, and then several of the Cambodian IVSers. Because there was a contingent in Cambodia about 64, but they were kicked out about then, and they came to Laos, or most of them did.
Sihanouk, was it, yeah, Sihanouk decided that he got pissed off.
Yeah. And he got kicked off because of U.S. policy. But he was crazy, so I mean, you can't blame the IVSers.
I tried to find June's, I have an address for June, but she didn't send in any form, and I don't have her phone number.
I can give it to you.
Okay.
If it's not here, it's at my shop.
Okay, great.
But I can pick it up right now if you want.
No, afterwards we can just look it up. It's not as long as we get it eventually, since I'm here.
Yeah, she's just 10 minutes down the road from
Great. Well, so I kind of grew up on the beach in Venice, so I'm really kind of comfortable with this, starting off this way, so to speak. Okay, well, actually, I think the way we intended to start this is, I'm just going to ask you some what we call just a biographical frame, just to start off, and I'll just say something like, it's Tuesday, June 11th, 1996, and we're talking to Howard Lewin. Howard, when were you born?
July 38th.
1938. And where?
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, California. Did you go to high school in Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Where was that?
Hamilton High School.
Hamilton High School. That's the Western League. I went to University High School.
So oh, okay. Right. Well,
yeah.
I graduated in 56.
In 56.
In fact, we're having our 40th reunion this weekend.
My 30th is October 5th. I just found out, calling folk in San Francisco, they reminded me that, which is great. I said, that's wonderful. I'm coming back from India. I'll be very thin. Everything will be fine. I'll look great. Less hair, but less flesh as well. One of the issues that I think people who are not interested in Southeast Asia are going to be interested in is the background of people who decided to go into development work overseas. Is there something, if you had to think of something in your formative years, your example of your parents or church, school, synagogue kind of thing?
Parents, no. Church, no.
What did your parents do?
My father was a warehouse supervisor. My mother was a legal secretary. When I was at university in Santa Barbara, I was in the master's program working and then starting on the doctorate. It dawned on me that I hadn't done anything other than go to school for a lifetime. And after I received my master's degree, I had to make a decision. Was I going to go on 3 more years? Because I knew if I did, then I would never, ever leave the ivy-hallowed walls. So I made a deliberate decision to go overseas or go somewhere for 2 years. Also, at that time, you'll remember there was a draft, and either you went in the Army, or you went in the Peace Corps, or you went IVS, or you said, I'm a conscientious objector. And I really didn't want to go in the Army after having been in ROTC in college, although I thought it would be a neat idea when push came to shove. Because of my eyes, the only thing I qualified for was a desk job. And I wasn't really excited about that. So IVS offered an opportunity for me to take 2 years out of school, do something in lieu of military training or military service, and give an opportunity to share what I knew. You know, it fit a broad range of reasons.
How did you hear about IVS?
A fellow by the name of Kirk Dimmitt came by school to visit a friend of his, and he had some slides on Vietnam. And when I was talking to him, I said, gee, that looks like something I could really, really do. And he sent my name in. Next thing I knew, I had an application, and it was filled out, and I was accepted.
What year was that?
63. And no one called me up. No one asked me for an interview. I was just signed up, you know, because of Kurt, his recommendation, I guess. I must have impressed him. I'm not sure what exactly.
And that Kurt Dimmick?
Dimmitt.
Dimmitt.
He was Vietnam. And later with, I believe, the CIA in Laos. Very bright guy, agriculture engineer. And in that, we were colleagues, so to speak, because while my master's degree was in history, I worked my way through school in construction. Mm-hmm. And when I went overseas, originally I was supposed to go to Vietnam, but then they switched me to Laos. I became a constructionist. They called me a constructionist because of my background. So, in that sense, we were at least on the same wavelength. We understood each other. And later on in Laos, we worked on a couple projects together up in the mountains. But that was after I was with USAID.
In 63, you had completed your master's degree, and you were thinking about going on. Were you accepted in a doctoral program then?
It was just... You weren't accepted. You just—it was just assumed.
Just assumed. I know that's a UC system. That's where it was with me as well.
You just go, you know.
Right.
And I knew, in the novel, 2 years before the mass. What's his name? God. I'm becoming a half-heimer here.
That's okay. I can't remember it either.
In the novel, 2 years before, it wasn't a novel, it was a sort of a biographical sketch, mm-hmm. of Dana.
Dana.
In the preface, he says he was studying law at Harvard or Yale or something. And he decided to take 2 years off. And he sailed in a way, I think it was a whaler to California, and then got on a ship loading hides back to Boston. And he knew that if he didn't come back within 2 years, he would never complete his studies. And when I went overseas, I gave myself 2 years. I just wanted 2 years off. Well, at the end of the 2 years with IBS, apparently I'd impressed enough people and AID hired me. I knew that that was taking a chance. Because another year in Laos was 3 years away from school. And by then, my colleagues are graduating with their doctorates. And I'm not even in the ball game anymore. And I knew it. And when I came back, I had an interview with my mentor. He says, "Well, you're ready, you're coming back." And I said, "Sorry, no."
Who was that?
A guy by the name of Dr. Jacobs in the history department. Well, actually, there were two or three guys that were sort of my sponsors. And I said, "Well, why?" And I says, "Because I'm making $12,000 a year." Well, no one made, in 1966, mm-hmm. no one was making $12,000 a year. Not even a college professor mm-hmm. with tenure and a PhD was making $12,000 a year. And so the monetary reason was one, but I just decided that being a professor was not for me. I learned in Laos that I was a doer. And not just a doer in the sense of an innovator, a problem solver, that kind of thing. Give me a project, tell me where you want it, and I'll get it done. And I found that to be very exciting and challenging. And in IVS, it gave me an opportunity to do that. The first year I was in IVS, I was in a small village, Boracan. And I was a constructionist with Gus Carlson, who's in Connecticut. And Gus did the building. I did a latrine program, a hand-dug well program. And we dug 20-something wells. we built, God, I don't know, like, I don't know, maybe 100 water sealed privies. You know, we furnished cement, taught them how to make it. We made the molds, you know, out of clay. And actually, we used bamboo for reinforcing rod and concrete to make the well ring. I mean, it was really an exciting thing. And I developed a bamboo pump using a bolt and some old inner tube and bamboo, and we can pump water 30 feet. You know, just basic 19th century engineering that I had learned.
Well, speaking of 20th century engineering, Tim actually can't take that phone call back there. His voice is turning going to turn up on this tape.
Oh, no.
So
okay.
If he has a door you can close back there, that'd be okay.
Okay.
But phone things are the worst possible thing.
Okay. Tim, could you close the door? Close the sliding door on the phone, because it's coming up on here. Yeah, go in the in the kitchen and close the sliding door.
Oh, this door.
Yes.
Great.
Okay. Oh, well, yeah.
Okay. Good. Well, let's backtrack
okay, I'm
a minute.
Sorry.
No. When Demet talked to you about joining the IVS, and you filled out some forms and...
Yeah, well, we talked, and then I said, gee, that sounds like fun. The next thing I knew, I had forms in the mail, and I filled the forms out and sent them in. In fact, I was going through some old papers, and I found a letter that I wrote to my draft board.
That's the next question I was going
to ask. Asking permission, yes. Can I go to Southeast Asia? Uh-huh. And he said, no! Uh-huh. And I wrote a long letter. I mean, I've got I just found it today, cleaning out some junk. And what actually happened was IVS had a sponsor in the Selective Service system by the name of General Hershey, who was in charge of it.
Oh, he was, yeah.
And I guess they sent him a letter saying, hey, we want this guy. And the next thing I know, my draft board said, okay. In fact, when I went down, my draft board was in L.A., and I was still in school at Santa Barbara. I drove down for a hearing, you know, all dressed up, prepared to, and the guy is reading. He says, well, Mr. Lewin, apparently this organization really wants you, because I have a letter here from General Hershey saying to say, okay. And it was okay. I knew also at the time, since I got, I got my master's degree when I was 25 or 24. I knew that if I went with IVS for 2 years, that I wouldn't have to worry about the draft anymore.
Right.
Because when you're 26, they weren't bothering you. Mm-hmm. So that was a nice bonus.
In later years, was it more or less draft boards were more readily understanding? That is, they knew that people who selected IVS, or did they have to go through appeal process?
I think they probably, I don't know, but I would guess that they all had to do the same thing, especially once the Vietnam War got well underway. Okay. The ironic thing is that I probably experienced more combat with aid than I ever would have as a soldier, because of my poor eyesight. I would have been in a desk somewhere, you know, in Saigon, in a liaison or a supply situation. Mm-hmm. In Laos, Gus, myself, and another IVSer, Frank Bewitz, we all went with Public Works. We were out there. I mean, we were building the roads and bridges that the bad guys either didn't want or wanted. And depending on their particular policy at the time, we were allowed or not allowed to finish our project. We had, Gus and I were sharing the other night, as a matter of fact. I called him up on the phone. I talk to him about once a year. And we were talking about things that we'd kind of forgotten about or buried, you know. And one of the IVSers who was killed, I can't remember his name, was down. Gus left a note on that man's door saying, you got to get out of here. He wasn't there when Gus was sent there to do this on the way somewhere else. And he wasn't there, so he wrote a note and put it on the door. And the guy, the kid, ignored the note, stayed there one night too long. Yeah. And they killed him there that night. Talk about guilt.
Or no guilt.
Well, Gus probably felt...
I know, I had a similar experience. I know that feeling.
And I had an IVSer killed under my supervision down in Poxa. Mm-hmm. Later, well, it's not part germane to this. You know, but,
well, we're not there yet.
Yeah, we'll get there.
After you went to your draft board,
yep.
And you had a hearing,
yep.
And what happened then?
They said okay, essentially, because if they would have said no, I couldn't have gone. You know, and I. Well, the interesting thing was I kind of liked ROTC. I thought it was great, but I talked over with the commander, you know, the guy in charge. He said, I hate to tell you this, Howard, but you know, because of your eyesight, you can become an officer, but you're never going to see combat. You're going to see a desk, and they, you know, you need 10 of those guys for one of those with a rifle. And I said, well, that doesn't sound like a lot of fun to me, and that's when I dropped that ROTC.
Why did you join ROTC in the first place?
It was a requirement at Santa Barbara at the time. You had 2 years required ROTC.
And this was the University of California?
University of California, Santa Barbara. It was required of every male student. And we had the freshman class. When I started Santa Barbara, the freshman class was 1,000 strong out of 1,800 students. It was a small school at the time. Well, there were 500 men. And all of a sudden, ROTC was big stuff. And it was required up until the time I left.
It's amazing because my cousin Tom went there then, and I visited him in Isla Vista, I think, once, when he was living in a student house, you know, an apartment or something.
Yeah.
And it never occurred to me that he must have, when he was an undergraduate,
yeah.
He must have.
Freshman, sophomore, required.
Interesting.
And then, if you're interested, you went upper division. Now, upper division had some perks. I mean, you signed on to become a second lieutenant, and during the summer you went to summer camp, did your basic training. At the end of your fourth year, you graduated as a second lieutenant, providing you could do another 10 weeks of physical training, and then depending on your field, what you went into, you became an officer and a gentleman, etc., and so on and so forth.
And I think I've sent about 300 people through that program where I teach.
Yeah. Well, it was fascinating. I mean, we played war. You know, we fired guns, we threw hand grenades. You know, it was pretty, you know, that was kind of my stuff.
You jumped out of airplanes and everything.
Well, I didn't do that.
I went for the advanced training.
Okay. Well, I didn't do that. Yeah. And, but when they, you know, it lost its appeal. I mean, why would you go to the Army to be a desk clerk? I mean, I couldn't do it. And I learned that much about myself in grad school. But after I got my master's degree, I couldn't sit on my ass that long anymore for a while. Toughest thing I ever had to do was sit in that library. Not the studying part. I mean, that was great. But I just couldn't sit still for more than an hour at a time. And some of my colleagues, they loved it. 5 hours in a pop, they never moved a goddamn muscle.
They were probably medieval historians.
I couldn't believe it. How could you guys sit here this long? You know, God, demented people. You know, I mean, I had to get up and pace the floor every hour. I'd go insane. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I've always been. I mean, I didn't realize it, but my brother... we were talking, he said, well, how are you never got more than 6 hours of sleep when you were a kid? I said, what do you mean? Well, you never went to sleep before 1 or 2 in the morning. And same thing true now, you know, I'm getting a little more now. And in Laos, I don't ever get more than 6 hours of sleep. There was just some clock in me that clicked on and off. So, okay, guy. But you're not going to be able to take Hovis for a walk?
Oh, no.
Oh, boy. Okay. I'll suffer.
Sorry.
Okay. Our dog has to get his evening walk, and if he doesn't, he gets a little feisty. But I mean,
well, after you were went through the process of being accepted by IBS, what physically happens to you after you get a letter saying?
What physically happened? Well, I was still finishing up school, and I had applied for a couple of jobs, a teaching job up in Northern California, which came through. And I had to call the guy and tell him, sorry, I had to turn you down, and I'm going with IBS. Who are they? And I told him, he said, you want more money? I'll get you more money. And I said, it's not a money thing right now. Maybe 2 years from now it'll be a money thing. But he desperately needed a high school history teacher to participate in, as he put it, a school disciplinary problem or project. And this was in a very rural town north of Lake Tahoe in the Sierra, a place called Loyalton, California. And it sounded great. Mm-hmm. Never been there, and I was ready to move up there and teach school. But when IBS came through, I decided to do that because that was definitely a 2-year contract. And it would have been over in 2 years, and I'd be free to do what I wanted, or whatever I thought I wanted. The thing about the teaching job in Loyalton, I was a little worried that if I took it, I might be there forever. And that's the way things worked out in Laos. You know, I was there for 12 years.
And I felt the same way about a girlfriend I had then. If I continue this relationship, this will be it for the rest of my life.
That's right.
Yeah, I just wasn't ready at 20
years
old.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, that happens to us, you know. It's very, well, with women, you know, men have a very big disadvantage. I am convinced, and I teach adult ed, and I give some of my theories to my women students. Because 80% of my women, 80% of my students are women. Uh-huh. And we're doing woodworking and this kind of thing. So, you know, I share my theories with them. And if I'm right on, they say, right. So I came up with this idea. I said, you know, you women really are smarter than us guys.
No question about that.
And they said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, between the age of 16 and 18, men suffer a 3-foot drop in IQ, and they never recover from it. They all say, you got that right.
Certainly to all appearances, they lose a great deal of their brains.
Well, my dad was 81 when he died, and about when he was 80 years old, I asked him, I said, you know, Dad, I don't know, did you have this problem? Did it ever get better? He said, I'm still waiting.
When you canceled out of the teaching job, did you go? Was there a place where you went to a kind of basic training for your IBS then?
Yeah, I was. We had an orientation in Washington D.C. I don't remember if it was 2 weeks or 10 days, but once I was accepted, they say, okay, you're going to this IBS orientation. It was held at George Washington University, both the IBS teams from Vietnam and Laos were there. And basically what it was, we talked with ex-IBSers or IBSers from Laos and Vietnam. A guy named Larry Ulsacker was particularly, God, I don't know where I got that name, was particularly helpful to me. Because I'd ask him a question, he gave me an answer. Now, Larry lost a leg, was on a, I don't know if it was from the hip or from the knee, I think it was from the hip, and was in IBS Laos. And one of his projects was trying to get a program started for the soldiers who had lost limbs. But I don't know what happened to Larry. I don't know whether he stayed in Laos. He didn't stay in Laos. He went somewhere else. But I think every IMSer that I talk with wanted to have a first-hand I'm trying to think of the right word, and I'm just going to lose it. Wanted someone who had been there and could tell them from personal experience. But turn off or
no. I wanted to see if there's a there's a light. I just want to make sure the light was off.
Yeah. From a first-hand experience, someone who'd been there had done that and was telling us about it. And it's ironic because after I finished IDS for 2 years, I went on contract with AID, and then I was made career status, direct hire. And I had to go to Washington for orientation. I said, wait a minute, guys, I spent 3 years there. I can orientate you. They said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, what program have you got? What are you going to teach me that I don't know? I ended up writing a 20-page paper for AID that they could give to their people going to Laos for the first time. In IDS, the only information that I remember of value were people like Larry, who had been there. And of course, the people who were in Vietnam were giving their first-hand experiences too, but nothing ever prepares you totally. I mean, I had one person say, well, make sure you peel the tomatoes. Who's going to peel tomatoes? Yeah, give me a break.
I mean... during the briefings, were there any outside IBS staff that participated in the briefings?
Yeah, there were... I think that everyone that came to our seminars and workshops had been in IBS in one of the foreign countries, you know, Vietnam, Laos, or wherever. And all of the experiences that they talked about and discussed were helpful. But, you know, if you've never been somewhere and you want to know, you know, like, what's it like? Tell me the truth, this kind of thing. It has to be someone who's, you know, been there, done that, mm-hmm. kind of a person. And it can't be an academic who has never been there.
But did they bring academics in? Do you remember?
We had a few of them in there who were talking about religion mm-hmm. and talked about culture, but it was meaningless. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't relate to it until you've been there. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say Larry was very, very helpful, because having lived in the society and become acculturated, he understood where the academic who had never been there may have known it by the book, but didn't know it from reality, didn't know it firsthand. And that's always been the case. That's one of the reasons I was afraid to stay in school. How could you teach history when you've never been a part of it? When you've never done anything except take it off of a page and put it onto another page? I wrote my master's thesis was on a character that worked for George Washington. He was a scout for George Washington. It was Andrew Montour. And you're reading about marching four abreast in the forest, and the guerrillas, the Indians shooting them and not getting hurt. Well, until you've lived in a forest that was so thick, you don't understand what that means. Because no one's seen a forest that thick.
Yes, well, fortunately, historical tradition has changed, and if you haven't done field work...
Well, yeah, but in my time, yes. you know, who's... What do you mean they can't walk down the street four abreast? I mean, what are you talking about? And this guy was telling Washington, he says, look, General, you can't, at that time he was a colonel or a captain, you can't walk through the forest four abreast and not get your ass shot off. That's literally what he told Washington. Until you have seen a forest that thick, you can't comprehend the problems, military problems. You know, how can a guy get lost? You know, he follows the road, you know. Well, when there were no roads and the forest was thick and you could see 20 feet ahead, you get lost. So if you're a military historian and you want to know why General X screwed up because his guys went the wrong way, you can understand that if you've lived or worked in a forest. The same thing applies to an orientation. When I talk in front of this group of aid people going to Laos for the first time, having spent 3 years in Laos, I could assure them on many things. No, you don't have to peel your tomatoes. You know, aid health things were peel your tomatoes. What a ridiculous statement. You know what I mean? And when in IBS, there were a few who had that ability. But the academics didn't.
Did any, IBS briefing, were there any USAID briefers as well? No, just all IBS. People of IBS experience.
And it was, as I recall, a lot of the IBS stuff was religious. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, at that time. I just got to... My team in Boracan was a Mormon doing his two-year field service. Mm-hmm. And his task was to convert some of the Laotians to Mormonism. Well, I didn't realize it at the time because I'd never run across this. Mm-hmm. You know, having been brought up in Southern California, this is not one of the things you're, at least 30 years, 40 years ago, you were experiencing. And then there were a lot of church groups who sponsored programs, and at the time, I'm not sure, but I would guess that 20 to 30% of the IVSers were recruited through their religious groups. That may be an exaggeration, but it seemed like that was a lot. You know, it seemed like that was true.
When the briefing was over, what physically happens next?
Okay, I was just trying to think. I came back to L.A. As I recall, the orientation was in the summer of 63. And then, early summer, like June. In fact, I've got some pictures somewhere I took. It was June. And then I left for Laos and I arrived in August. So I was back home in L.A. for maybe a month or so before I went to Laos. And we flew, we met a group in Seattle, and then we all went from Seattle, flew from L.A. to Seattle, Seattle, Anchorage to Tokyo, and then Tokyo to Saigon, I believe. And then we took Royal Air Lao from Saigon to Vientiane. And that was a bumpy trip. I think it would have been better to go to Washington, D.C. and then go directly from there, rather than go home again. And because there was at least a month's hiatus there.
No problem. Okay, when you landed in Laos, what was your first reaction?
Shit. Heat. Landed in August. Thereabouts. That's the hottest time of the year, just about. And I've never experienced heat like that. And that was, Washington was warm. But, and L.A. gets its hot times. But I have never, up until that point, experienced heat like that. I made up my mind that I was on a camping trip for 2 years. And so my mind, and I'd done a lot of camping and backpacking way before it was fashionable to do so. And so I was prepared to accept whatever I saw and learn from whatever I, from wherever. So I didn't really have a problem. If the first couple of months, the heat was killer. But that's all I remember when I got off the plane, because I remember that door opening and this, whew, heat hitting me. I mean, that's the thing I remember the most, is getting hit. I remember mosquitoes a lot. Because I didn't speak the language yet, I was not acculturated. I really thought things were strange, but I accepted them. I mean, I just said, okay, that's the way it is here, and live with it. And I did. I didn't complain about this or that. Although I did kill a lot of mosquitoes that first night with spray. You know, I got some spray, and the guy in the room next to me said, God, am I, what are you trying to do, kill us? I said, you want to get eaten by mosquitoes, or you want to smell a little dust? You know, God. I think the problem with a lot of IVSers is they went over there with an agenda in their head, whether it was religious or whether they were going to pursue a particular concept or idea, and you just can't. You couldn't do that. I mean, these people, it became readily apparent, I mean, almost immediately apparent, that the technology there just didn't exist to do big things. You had to do a lot of little things first. In fact, recently I was visited by the Minister of Interior. June brought him over to my shop, talking to me about some problems he was having. And he said, you're the first American I've talked to who understands the technical limits and technology that we have. You know, they want to sell him computer this and technology that, and he's got guys there that can barely fix automobiles. So, I mean, this is what big difference between, I think, Laos and Thailand, where they were exposed to it earlier, understood that. And because the chief of public works, when I started working for public works, had done a lot of work in Thailand in the 50s. And he said, where we are in Laos today is where Thailand was right after the war. The only difference is they understood it and wanted to change it. And Laos, while they may want to change it, hasn't got, because of the war and everything else, just isn't able to. And there's something else too, I'm not sure. I think it's probably the French underlying educational, you know, not education, but philosophical attitude, which is devastating. Almost every French colony is the same major problem. I mean, the French never built a cement plant in Southeast Asia, in Indochina. They imported cement from France. You can't do anything without cement. There isn't one thing you can do. And so the French would utilize their cement. They'd make cement floors that thick. Sprinkle a little cement and water on top, and that was their floor. When we came to make, we made concrete. And the French had a hard time with that because they'd never had the resources. And that attitude, of course, guided the Laotian aristocracy. You know, it's a throwback to the French economic beliefs that the pie never gets bigger. And to get part of it, you got to cheat somebody else out of a piece. I think that's still pretty much the same. I'm not sure. So, Penelope, is that you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi.
You can listen if you want.
Okay.
When you, after you were exposed to the heat, and you debarked at the airport, was there, did IBS have a billet for you?
So? Yeah, there was a kind of a dorm arrangement for all the new people. And we lived there 3 weeks, maybe a month. We went to class every day, learning language, getting oriented, whatever. Learning who our aide liaisons were, and then trying to get, they were talking about the cluster program, which was, they were all over the country, and there'd be an IVS team in each cluster. And cluster was a group of villages, 20 to 30 villages, and we would work in all 20 or 30 villages, doing this, that, and the other thing. And the orientation was primarily geared to explaining where we fit in with the aid program. And of course there was I remember talking to the deputy director of aid, and I said, look, you know, you're putting us out there, and if we're successful, the bad guys aren't going to like that. What are they going to do about that? Oh, don't worry about that. Well, a couple instances where it became life-threatening. A couple of the clusters, and some IBSers died. Maybe not because the cluster program was successful. In the one case, that guy was told to leave. He didn't. Mm-hmm. The bad guys lost face and had to zap him. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the guy working for me down south. He was told in no uncertain terms by his Lao counterparts not to go back, to get out. Because they'd been informed by the bad guys that if he didn't, he was going to die. Well, you know, when the bad guys issued an order and you ignored it, they lost face, and they had no recourse. I don't think it was something they particularly wanted to do, but they had to prove who was boss. And if you understood that, you could survive. If you didn't understand that, you were a goner. And that was the same whether you were working with locals or not. There was an American technician in Thailand who berated his crew so much that they lost face. And one day a guy turned around and hit him on the head with a hammer. You know, just one day he was a nice guy, and the next day he was a dead guy, you know. That didn't happen that much. But I've seen Americans fail there because they didn't understand that. You know, here in the States, you get a guy pissed off. He says, okay, that's enough. Leave me alone, or I'm going to kick the shit out of you. Mm-hmm. In Laos, it was, you bug me too much, and you're dead. You know, and then Thailand, the same. I suspect Cambodia was also, although I didn't spend that much time in Cambodia.
So you were assigned to, after some language training, you were assigned to one of the clusters?
One of the clusters, the Borakon cluster. Paksan was on the Mekong River, and we were up the Namsan River, 35 kilometers. And it was 6 hours by boat. And when you look at a map, you know why, because the river went like this, and the road went straight. But it was 6.5, maybe even longer hours by boat. You go up there, you don't want to go back because you know it's 6.5 hours to get back again. But it was a beautiful ride. I mean, you know, Conrad couldn't have written it any better. I mean, you're going up this river, you know.
The horror.
Yeah. I mean, the horror. You know. Yes. And you don't know what's there when you get there, you know.
Well, what was there when you got there?
Well, it's very interesting. It was a beautiful, you couldn't believe the scene. The Nam San came through a gorge of limestone. And this karst ran for like 100 kilometers. And it was broken here by the Nam San River. Couldn't build a dam on it because it was limestone. The water was clear, not, except one after big heavy rain. And there were three villages. I've written them down somewhere. I can't even remember them. The villagers were recent arrivals. By that I mean maybe 100 years before they migrated from further north. And they were the Taipun. They weren't Laotian. Mm-hmm. They were sort of a semi-nomadic, and they moved to this village area. And they spoke a dialect of Laos. It was interesting, you know, and in Lao, you say, Paisai, where are you going? They would go, Paikalu, you know, which is, and to me, it was, as a historian, it was fascinating, because I was able to get a little history, at least one generation back, because beyond that, hardly anybody could remember. But apparently, they'd been there 100, maybe 150 years, and they had come from further north. Just an absolute idyllic setting. At night, we would bathe in the river on the sandbar. Across the river, monkeys were playing in the bamboo and the trees. And the IVS team consisted of four guys and a gal. And we, the first thing we did was we built an emergency airfield for evacuation. Public works guy came up there and we blew some trees and villagers helped cut some stuff down. And we started our projects and things went reasonably well. One guy was kind of a useless guy. This is the guy that was kind of a Mormon. What was it? Phillips? Philip? Phil something. And then there was an ag guy, and Gus and I were constructionists, and the gal was a home economist type. And I was going to try to remember what I was going to say.
They obviously, there have been, how long have the IVS presence been in?
We were the first.
So the people who were, you came as a group? So there never had been anyone
there
before?
No IVS are in there, no team or anything.
So who organized, let's say, cutting down the airfield?
We did.
How did you approach the village headman? What was the social structure?
Yeah, well, the Chow Mung, Chow Mung was kind of like a county supervisor. The county supervisors rule the county, and then under him are mayors of the various cities. Well, Chow Mung, and then under him were Da Sangs, which are like heads of two or three villages. Mm-hmm. And then Naibans, which are heads of villages. And so everything we did was work through that system. We'd have a village meeting. And we would say, look, for us to stay here, we have to have an emergency field for this, that, and the other thing. So we need some help, you know, where would be a good place to build it? And the villagers will say, that place over there. No, that place over there. Work that out. We cut a few trees down, blow a few stumps, and that's our airfield. For the construction projects, like a school, where do you want it? And this is what we need to do. We'll furnish the cement and the nails and stuff, you guys have to haul sand and gravel, and we'll build a school. And they say, fine. Or, you know, you have to cut down trees and make some boards and whatnot. And it was all worked out. The Lao village was probably the most democratic place I'd ever been to. It reminded me a lot of the old New England village meetings where everyone participated. And, you know, I'd always been told that the women didn't have much to say in Laos. Well, I got news for you. The women rule the roost. The men might say the words, but the women are telling them what to say. And in every village meeting, the women had equal voice in what was said and what was done. Although the final decisions were made by men, they knew they better make the right ones. They may walk 20 feet ahead of the women, but the women were running it. Not running it, but mm-hmm. at least had equal say in what was going on. So we worked through the structure. I wasn't good at that. You know, just tell me where you want it and we'll build it. Mm-hmm. But we had guys on the team, and then we had a community development advisor, aid guy, who we were nominally under. You know, he never stayed there with us, mm-hmm. but he was our support. And he worked through the Chao Quang, which is the governor
of the province.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just our group that he worked for. I mean, he worked with the Chao Quang on a number of levels, because there was a travel public, there was a public health people, there was a uses people, and all these events. He was a coordinator of events, so to speak. And but when we ran into a problem, like the Chao Moon doesn't want to do this, and we think we should, then we went to him, he went to the Chao Quang. If the Chao Quang thought we were right, he would tell the Chao Moon, okay, that's what you've got to do. And I remember the first couple of weeks we were there, we wanted to live off the local economy. But there were five Americans. And the little market
mm-hmm. couldn't sustain us.
You know, we go to the market, we buy a dozen eggs, and that were the eggs. Yeah. And that was it. And nobody else could have eggs. And of course, we had the money, so we said, Yami, do you want it? Okay, sure, right. Well, man, that... We were told in no uncertain terms by the Chao Moon, look, I can't afford you guys. Buy your own food somewhere else. So then we had to go to the commissary, and we would bring food in from Vientiane. You know, we ordered everything from there.
How did you place the order?
We made up a list every week, and that went by boat down to Paksan, into the pouch from Paksan, because of... The milk run went from, if you can believe this, Vientiane to Paksan was the first. Paksan, Takek, Takek, Savannakhet, Savannakhet, Pakse. Mm-hmm. That was the southern milk run twice a week. And then the northern milk run was Sayaburi, Luang Prabang, Ban Hui Sai, and that was twice a week. So there was a plane, and all of our supplies would come to Paksan, then it had to be boated in the wet season and then driven in the dry season. Driving was an hour. Boat was six or longer. It was closer to eight. Six going back, eight going up. And it was just a long trip. So we supported ourselves, canned goods. You know, couldn't have frozen goods because it would thaw out by the time it got there. So everything was canned. And I remember, I've got a picture of this at my shop. We were given an elephant to take care of, the IBS team. Baby elephant. You know, that high.
And later when you got older, you wrote the script for Dumbo Drop.
Well, no, but what happened? We didn't know why they gave it to us. So it turns out the damn thing drank 5 gallons of milk a day. And we were the only ones that could afford it.
Well, what was the significance of the elephant for the village?
Well, the mother had been killed. How, I don't remember. And the baby was not quite old enough to be on its own. That damn thing went to us to the river to bathe at night. I think we had it, I'm guessing, 3 months. I've got pictures of us getting sprayed by the elephant, and we dumping water on it. And after a while, it just followed us everywhere we went, just like a damn dog. You know what I mean? And when I tell people this, no, and every time I see that movie Hatari, you know, I say, hey, there's my...
there's your elephant.
There's our elephant. I mean, it was...
When it grew up, did it move into the labor force?
Well, they took it away because it was time to start training it. Mm-hmm. By then, it was pretty much weaned. And I don't know if it was a year. It had to be 2 years old or something like that. And it was time to start training it. So, thank you. And hasta luego, you know. And I got a chance to see other elephants trained. Not a very pleasant thing to watch. But I worked a lot with elephants in Laos. Use them to haul cargo, pull things. I've got a photograph, later on when I worked with Abe, we were building a road, and I have a photograph of 100 elephants going up our road, tail to snout for about a kilometer, all carrying 2 bags of cement. They couldn't carry much on their back. They could pull a ton. But the Lao never developed a sledge or a cart. It was beyond their technology. If you can believe it. Now the Thai built beautiful carts. The Lao took a log, cut a cross section, and that was their wheel. Very inefficient, fell apart real quick. Thai would build wheels that were 8 foot in diameter. The spokes, gorgeous. I mean, just incredible. The Lao never were able to do that. I don't know why. They weren't that far apart. It was just a river across it. I'm sorry.
No. The USAID folk would come. He would probably have a circuit where he would come to different projects
We call him a CDA, Community Development Advisor.
Right.
And this guy's name was George. And why I can remember George, I don't know. George something or other.
Dally. Yeah, I know him.
Yes.
I had a feeling George would turn up somewhere here.
George is...
He's...
Was something else than... I don't know what he is now.
In what sense? Oh, he's not a friend.
He's just... you know, it would be like casting him to play the Lone Ranger. It was a total mismatch, you know. And his boss, who was the actual area coordinator, whom I can't recall right now. I mean, I don't know where George studied. I don't know where he got his degree. We had a long, we talked a lot together and that sort of thing. But to me, community development has got to place its emphasis on infrastructure. You can't do shit without roads. You can't do things without education. And you can't do anything if everybody's dying around you. And that has nothing to do with psychology, that has nothing to do with anything else except common practical sense. I mean, that's what our whole program in Laos should have been. But we had a lot of highfalutin words about this, that, and the other thing, just in a country where you couldn't get fresh meat to market because it took too long. And so here's one end with pigs and another end without, and there was nothing you could do about it.
If we could stop for one second, sure. Could you ask her to close that door?
Yeah, let me close that door. Probably coming through. The one thing I learned, and here we've learned it in the States. A great example, this area of Manhattan Beach. When I was a kid, it took us an hour and a half from my house in West LA, and we would come down Sepulveda, and I remember the refinery at the corner of Rosecrans and Sepulveda. It was sand dunes. All the way through Hermosa Beach, this was sand dunes. That was in the late 50s. 50 to 54. And it was that way up until maybe 60. Then they built San Diego Freeway.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden this became accessible. And people started moving here. Prior to that, you couldn't get here and you couldn't get to downtown from here.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't. Once a freeway went in, so why should we be surprised? I mean, that was something we learned in the 18th century. Without roads, you can't have an economy. If you can't get the goods to market, we were lucky we had a river system. Mm-hmm. Laos had a river system. But fortunately, it was very hard to go north on that river. It was a lot easier to go south. To me, the whole premise on the community development activities, by and large, was slightly twisted. Without good communications.
Well, was it overambitious in that sense? Did they?
Yeah, I mean, they were talking more about. Let's see if I can phrase it right. A dug well gave you a potable water supply. That's important. I don't think it was as important as good ground communications. There's being able to get the pigs from Mung Cao 20 kilometers or 30 kilometers south to Pak San. Because that gives the people of Mung Cao access to goods down there. Gives those people access to food that they couldn't get any other way. While a well was important, this is a little bit of hindsight. It seemed to me, and I think Gus and I talked about this, building a school was important. But, you know, you have to be able to fund these things. How do you fund them without taxes? How do you fund them without trade? You can't do anything without those things, you know? And we're talking about a village where a wealthy man had 3 water buffalo. And I remember talking to this one villager, he wanted a motorcycle. And I said, well, how many buffalo have you got? He said, I got 15. I said, get rid of 3 buffalo or 4 buffalo, you got a motorcycle. He had never equated a motorcycle